Welcome to Michigan Writers on the Air, a program about writers, writing, reading, and listening here in northern Michigan. I'm Aaron Stander. In the opening interview, Anne Marie Oman will be here to talk about and read from her stunning new memoir, Love, Sex, and 4-H. Then we'll hear the story of Jeep, the coyote who flew in World War II. Actor Benjamin Bush will read the story, and after, I'll chat with the author, Sharon Chickering Mahler. At the end, Fleeta Brown will have a commentary on Michigan poet Sharon Imers. I would like to welcome Anne Marie Oman back to Michigan Writers on the Air. Welcome, Anne Marie.
Thank you.
Anne Marie is a memoirist, poet, and playwright. Until her retirement in 2014, Anne Marie was a faculty member at the Interlaken Arts Academy. Today we will be talking about Anne Marie's newest memoir, Love, Sex, and 4-H, from Wayne State University Press.
Thank you.
It's a wonderful book, Anne Marie.
Thank you.
Enjoyed reading it so much. This new book follows your two earlier memoirs, Pulling Down the Barn and House of Fields. Those two titles focused on growing up in rural Michigan in the 50s and 60s. And those books attracted a wide audience, and I think it's because of your approach to memoir. Could you talk about that?
Oh, sure. And thank you. It's an honor to be back here, Aaron, always. I found early on when I began writing nonfiction myself that it did little good in terms of the writing and in terms of the story to honor that old adage about start at the beginning. It just didn't seem to work very well. And in my teaching, I was encountering people who wanted to write memoir or life stories, and they would always want to do just that, start at the beginning. And as I learned more about the craft myself, which took some time, I found that the memoirs I loved and the memoirs that seemed to ring true to me didn't do that. It didn't do the kindergarten teacher or worse, the potty training or, you know, the first spanking or any of that. It didn't start with that. Rather, it started with a central moment. And over time, I began to think about life writing in terms of selecting transformative moments around a theme or an ideal or some central concept. So to choose transformative moments, which we all have literally hundreds of them if we stop and think carefully about that, and let the rest fall away. Don't try to tell all of that, and particularly don't try to succumb to something that just seems amusing because it's amusing. Try to find moments that really have, whether they're quiet, and they could be really quiet, or really big moments. It could be something like the first time you realize that you have an identity alone, you know, that you are an alone person, or that's a quiet moment, at least it is for me. Or it could be something as big as like your first car accident or your marriage or something like that. But those are transformative moments. And by focusing on those, you give yourself a way to wade through the mass of life and to find, for lack of a better metaphor, an island. And so I construct memoir or memoir pieces based on identifying transformative moments.
Those two books, Pulling Down the Barn and House of Fields, have those transformative moments, but the new book, in addition to the transformative moments, follows a chronology. We are talking about the 60s, essentially, 1959 to 1969.
69, yes. Those 10 years are the 10 years that I was in 4-H Club. So I earned what my mother was proudly wanting me to earn, which was the 10-year pin. And so I started when I was 8, in very, very early rudimentary lessons. And those 10 years in 4-H happened to correspond chronologically with the 60s. And so in this book, what I saw as I thought about it was this this kind of dichotomy or this division of life into these really beautiful, wholesome lessons about taking care of yourself, being able to sew your own clothes, being resourceful and wholesome and responsible. I mean, the 4-H pledge is one of the most, you know, responsible things. I pledge my heart to clearer thinking, my head to greater loyalty, my hands to larger service, my health to better living for my club, my community, and my country. I can still say it. So that, but set against the times that were changing. And so the narrative is a little more episodic. It's more of a chronicle centered on the conflict created by those two forces in me. And I think in some way they are representative of those people who, like myself, were not out there marching and were not at the forefront of that change, but we're still caught in the spill of it. Mm-hmm. And yet we, in my case, I still had an immense amount of the old world as well. So I wanted to write about the tensions and the divisiveness that was created in people like me and myself. Me, but that I felt that was rich.
Mm-hmm. And that comes through in the background. The zenith is on, mm-hmm. and the mm-hmm. Cuban Missile Crisis is taking place.
Yes.
There are assassinations. There
yes.
are riots in the street. The
yes.
war goes on. And mm-hmm. you sort of, the TV's always running in the background, and you're responding in a way, maybe not directly, but it's part of your life.
That's exactly right. I think ours was that first generation to have the TV on most of the time, and what is now dominated by the cell phone and the computer was at that time, you know, it was Walter Cronkite and the Huntley-Brinkley News Hour, and I think it's pretty commonly acknowledged, we're the first generation that saw war come into the living room through the Vietnam War and those brave journalists. So it's the first time we felt the presence of the smaller world in such a concrete way.
There are two characters in this memoir, you and your mother.
Yes.
And the relationships of mothers and daughters are often very difficult. You and your mother managed to work it out with many challenges.
That's exactly right. My mother was, she was just a powerhouse. She is still living. She's 93 now and frail. But in that time, she was, you know, mother of five children, a growing and progressively more successful farm family. And she was also my 4-H leader.
Mm-hmm.
And something in my mother knew that the times were not going to stay safe mm-hmm. in that way that they had been for her, at least the post-war, the Eisenhower era. And she, I think, on some level sensed that. And 4-H was one of her public ways of keeping us in line, keeping us focused on stuff that was material and activities that were wholesome and American in every way, and were going to help us become wholesome, law-abiding citizens in the world. So 4-H was, and I think that actually succeeded to a great degree. 4-H was just exactly that for farm families. And she was just determined that I was going to be a capable woman. And one of the ways she understood that capability was by having some skills. And sewing, which is really at the center of much of this book, is how to sew, became the primary means to that. My brothers did the whole thing with the animals, and my sisters became avid horsewomen, but I was the one who got the sort of domestic arts, as they were called then.
I was really struck by that whole section, or it actually runs through the whole book, the sewing, how you sort of created your own character by creating your own wardrobe.
Mm-hmm.
It's something that I had never thought about.
Mm-hmm.
You know, men sort of grab a shirt and pants and wander away, but it was so important for you to express who you were and where you were at that moment by the clothing that you were making.
Mm-hmm.
And the choices of materials and styles. And
That's right. That's one of the things that the 4-H Club at that time, now 4-H, I need to preface this by saying 4-H has changed dramatically since then. But at that time, I think my mother was preparing me for how to be in public. The first two memoirs I wrote are, if you look at them closely, they're private,
mm-hmm.
and intimate.
And you're discovering the world the way a child discovers the world.
Right, exactly. And in this one, I am becoming a more public persona. And so the 4-H, the sewing, and the wardrobe was the way you presented yourself to the world. And the 4-H leaders, especially the ones who were teaching the sewing, the ones who were really attentive to that public persona, what you would be in the world, helped you study patterns, and they gave you the materials and the fabrics, and they taught you what was used best for what kind of style. And all of that was the sort of raw palette or the raw material for creating a style. And style for them was not just what was popular. It was creating a style, a persona. They studied the models on the covers of the patterns, you know, and Butterick and Simplicity and McCall's would say, you know, for an evening event or a day dress or casual, you know, that was a new term coming in at that mm-hmm. time. But they gave you this sort of way to enter the world and become a public, present a public figure, not become a public figure because that wasn't really encouraged, but to present your public persona. Amazing, mm-hmm. isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And they taught you how to walk on a runway.
Yes. Believe it or not, one of the things that the 4-H, each spring, there was a 4-H Achievement Day at that time. And at Achievement Day, those young women who'd been involved in the sewing projects modeled their outfits, their dresses, whatever they had made. And they taught us to walk and taught us how to turn and pivot and show
smile
and showcase the dress. And I think that's one of the things they 4-H wouldn't even consider now, which mm-hmm. I think is probably really, really good. But at that time, it was about that sort of public poise again,
mm-hmm.
and how you would then present yourself with both a little bit of dazzle maybe, but also with integrity, and that you could walk in a womanly way. And it was all part of that teaching. And then just to set up the contrast, think of this. This is coming at the same time that macrame and beads and the long hippie dresses and the Indian vests and all of that were sandals were all coming in at the same time. So the contradiction in styles at the time, I think, personifies part of the theme of the book.
I'm talking to Anne-Marie Ohman, and could I get you to read something from Love, Sex, and 4-H?
Yes, thank you. I'd love to. I'm going to read a passage from a chapter titled Jackie, February 1962, and this needs a little bit of a setup. I don't know how many people remember that Jackie renovated the White House and did so by bringing back many of the fine antiques that were stored in the basement of the White House and bringing them forth. And in February of 1962, she did a TV special, one of the first of its kind, an hour-long TV special showcasing what she was trying to do at the White House. And my mother and I watched this together. It's very close to Valentine's Day. And so this is where I'll start in the middle. Even my die-hard Republican mother, who believes in never wearing anything too showy, in choosing colors that don't show dirt, in saving every penny and reusing every piece of clothing, likes that Jackie dresses beautifully and walks gracefully. I do too. We like to see her slim frame in pictures so unlike our stocky bodies, and we always notice her wardrobe, a new word for me. We pay attention to her pillbox hats with little veils, her Chanel suits. My mother shakes her head at how much money these cost. We study her beauty, not quite sure what to do with it because there is so much of it. My mother is quick to judge uppityness, but other than asking if Jackie's wardrobe is paid for with tax dollars, my mother does not judge her. Instead, she watches, and so do I. But now, in front of the TV, we hear her voice. Jackie has a voice like, "It takes me a while to decide," like dark chiffon. She speaks carefully. Words become flowers, delicate and slow to bloom. This is how the First Lady becomes Jackie, a whole friendlier thing. But at the same time, her voice adds mystery to that friendliness. It fills the dining room, soft and glowing. The next thing I notice, my mother stands still, listening. As much as I want to listen to Jackie, I want to watch my mother, scissors poised in her hand. This voice has stilled my mother, stopped her ever swift movement toward the next pot of soup, the next broken bone, broken machine, broken heart. Something has quieted her nerves, something from the TV, from the outside world. I stack my paper valentines, listen to the voice, and watch my mother listen to Jackie talk about American antiques and collectibles, how she will gather them for the White House, how she thinks the White House should have the best things. And then she appears on the screen. I try to do two things at once. Watch my mother study the face, the dark hair, the heavy brows, her classic dress, lean lines on her slim body, and at the same time watch the screen. Here is something I have never seen before. She is like a model, but not a model. She is beautiful, but she isn't quite certain. She, the First Lady, is nervous and a little scared.
Beautiful. Thank you, Anne-Marie.
You're welcome.
This book will be out when this program airs. You've worked...
This has actually been 5 years.
Five years?
Yes.
And... your readers will go through it in an evening or two, and then they will be asking you, what's next?
Well, I'm writing, and this will not be surprising, I suppose, about the other character in this book. I'm writing about my mother, who is failing and still remains a force. And I am thinking a lot about this process of aging and letting go, because there are so many of us. You know, I wanted boomers to feel young again when they read this new book, Love, Sex, and 4-H. But in the book that's coming to me now, I'm feeling like I'm just reminding us all, and not to be pedantic or anything, but just reminding us all that there's an aging process that can be rich. And I'm just trying to record the things my mother says and what she's remembering and what she's thinking about. And that's all notes right now. But that's going to be something, I think.
And you'll probably write a series of poems and two or three plays along the way, correct?
I don't know.
You will be signing the books at various stores around the state. You will be doing readings and book talks. And
yes,
listeners can find you by going to your website.
Yes, www.annemarieohman.com. And I can also be reached by email. And I welcome invitations, and I want to share the book.
Terrific. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you, Aaron. It's always a pleasure. You make this show such a joy.
Thank you.
I appreciate it.
You're listening to Michigan Writers on the Air on IPR News Radio.
I'm Sally Isley, General Manager at Interlochen Public Radio. We are so grateful to the hundreds of people in Northern Michigan who have given recently in support of IPR, and for the hundreds who give monthly sustaining gifts. We're creating a great public radio community, and here's another way you can help. Tell us how you listen to us. Would you take just a few minutes to complete our online survey? Your feedback means a lot. Just go to interlochen.org/survey. Thanks.
You're listening to Michigan Writers on the Air on Interlochen Public Radio. In this segment of the program, I'll be talking with Sharon Chickering Moeller about her children's book, Jeep, the Coyote Who Flew in World War II. Before that conversation, actor, writer, and filmmaker Benjamin Bush will read the story Jeep. Welcome, Benjamin.
Thank you, Aaron. Hey, Ma, look what I found, said Walt, walking into the kitchen with a small bundle hugged close to his chest. What a cute puppy, she said, stroking the tan and white fur. Look closer, said Walt. It's not a dog. It's a coyote. He was curled up all alone against a fence post. He's so small, I almost didn't see him. What are you going to do with a coyote puppy, she asked. You're leaving in just a couple of days for the war. You can't leave a coyote puppy around here. Your father would have a fit. And so would the neighbors. I know Pa would tell me to shoot him, but he's awfully cute, said Walt. I'll think of something. When his father came in, he said, Walter, you're asking for trouble if that coyote is still here when you leave. Nobody around here is any friend of coyotes. That night, Walt put some old blankets in a box for the coyote and took it to his bedroom. When the coyote started whimpering, Walt lifted him into the bed beside him. The pup was soon fast asleep. In the morning, Walt woke up to find a wet tongue and a wiggling body in his face. Hey, guy, he laughed. Guess I better take you outside and then get the both of us some breakfast. For the next couple of days, the puppy followed Walt everywhere as he collected the gear he needed for his journey. Walt was both excited and scared. With all the talk on the radio, in the news features at the movie theater, and on the streets about stopping the Nazi army's march across Europe, he was anxious to do his part. He knew there would be danger, but he was young and ready to take on almost anything. He had sure been through a lot of training since he joined up with the Army Air Corps the year before. He loved the feeling of the P-47 airplane lifting off the runway. And he liked the way the plane responded to his touch, turning, soaring, and rolling. The most exhilarating part was a nosedive, heading straight toward Earth, then pulling out the last possible second. What a rush! He never told his mother this part, though, because he knew she would worry about him. Finally, the morning arrived for him to catch the bus to the train station in Omaha, Nebraska. Although the pup had been at his heels for the last couple of days, Walt still hadn't come up with a good plan. At the breakfast table, his father said, "You're taking care of that coyote, aren't you?" Yes, sir. He'll be no problem. Walt's parents walked him down the drive to the road where he would catch the Greyhound bus. As the bus came into view, his mother, trying to hold back the tears, said, "Be careful, Walt. We'll be praying for you." She gave him a tight hug and kissed him on the cheek. His father clapped him on the back and gave him a handshake. "Take care, son." As the bus came to a stop, Walt scooped up the coyote hidden in his trench coat and carried him onto the bus. In the seats just in front of Walt were a woman and her young son. The boy turned around and hung over the back of his seat, eyeing Walt in his trim dark uniform. "Are you going to the war?" he asked. "Yep, that's where I'm headed." "What are you going to do there?" "I'm going to fly airplanes. Fighter planes." "Wow, that's what I want to do when I grow up. A fighter pilot." All of a sudden, the coat in Walt's lap moved. "Hey, what's that?" asked the boy. "Shh," said Walt. "Can you keep a secret?" The boy nodded. Walt picked up the corner of the coat so the boy could see. "It's a coyote," he whispered. "Is he going to the war, too?" "I guess so," replied Walt. "What's his name?" "That's a good question. How about Jeep? Because I was riding in a Jeep when I found him." Walt opened his window, and the fresh spring air on his face made him feel more relaxed. The hum of the bus tires rolling over the highway made him sleepy. He was flying over France, trying to evade enemy aircraft. Oh, no! He'd taken a hit, and his plane was spiraling out of control toward Earth. Just as he pulled the cord on his parachute, he woke up with a start. Oh, what a dream, he thought, his heart thumping. I sure hope that isn't really what's going to happen to me. Wait, something was missing. Where was Jeep? Trying not to poke the person sitting next to him, Walt peered between his legs under the seat. Where could Jeep have gone? He didn't think the bus had stopped while he was asleep, so the coyote couldn't have gotten off. He made his way down the aisle of the bus, hanging on to seat backs to keep him losing his balance. "Lose something?" asked another passenger. "Yeah, it's got to be here somewhere." The bus was quiet except for people coughing or changing positions in their seats. At the back of the bus, he thought he heard a rustle. Getting down on his hands and knees, he peered under the seat. There was the coyote, chewing on a piece of wax paper, probably left over from someone's lunch. What if he's eaten someone's sandwich? Walt asked himself. "Excuse me," he said, reaching under the seat, and got a hold of the coyote by the scruff of the neck. "Come here, you rascal," he whispered, holding the animal so he would not be noticed. When he got back to his own seat, he rummaged around in his own duffel bag until he found a lunch his mother had packed for him. He divided his food with the coyote, who devoured it. Then, with a full belly, he curled up on Walt's lap and went to sleep. From the bus depot in Omaha, Walt and Jeep made their way to the train station. There, Walt found many more young men dressed in uniform, as he was, all headed for the war in Europe. Walt struck up a conversation with another young man, Jimmy, and discovered they had a lot in common. Both had grown up in rural Nebraska. Both were going overseas in the same ship, and both would serve in the same Army Air Corps base near Ipswich, England. When Walt showed the coyote to Jimmy, the pup reached up and licked his face. "Guess he likes you." "Yeah, I'm already missing my dogs at home." There was such a large crowd and so much turmoil around the train when Jimmy and Walt boarded that no one noticed the extra passenger. Walt was glad for another set of eyes to keep track of the roly-poly coyote. In Chicago and Washington, D.C., where the two airmen had to change trains, they took turns holding Jeep. It was late evening of the second day when they finally arrived at the naval base at Norfolk, Virginia. They knew they would be traveling across the Atlantic Ocean on a ship named Queen Elizabeth, so the next day they set out to find her. Neither Walt nor Jiminy had ever seen an ocean liner, so both were astonished when they saw the size of the huge gray ship. "It must be the length of at least 3 football fields," said Walt, remembering the years he'd played football for the University of Nebraska. "Or maybe even 4 fields long," said Jimmy. "Are you taking Jeep aboard?" "I've gotten him this far. I might as well try," said Walt. "But how am I going to hide him while I walk up the gangway in front of all those officers? They'll suspect something." While he pondered the situation, he put his duffel bag, gas mask, and other equipment down on the dock beside him. "Hey," said Jimmy, "Jeep isn't very big yet. I think he would just fit inside the case you have for your gas mask." "Huh, maybe that'll work." Walt removed his gas mask and placed it in an out-of-the-way alley, feeling sure he could find a replacement later. Jimmy was right. The puppy fit, but with only a little room to spare. Once the 2 men were aboard, they hurried to an inconspicuous place where they could let the pup out of the case. Jeep was so overjoyed by his release that he wiggled even more and gave slobbery kisses to both of them. They decided to take turns exploring the ocean liner while the other attended to the coyote. The ship was larger than either of the towns Walt or Jimmy had grown up in. Walt had no problem keeping the animal entertained. Many of his new friends were more than willing to help care for Jeep. The coyote reminded each of them of home. They took turns keeping him out of the way, and the ship's cooks even sent food scraps and an occasional bone for him to eat. Even before they'd gotten to their permanent base in England, the coyote had become the mascot of the 356th Fighter Group. He was no longer so little or roly-poly. His legs had gotten longer, as had his ears. Both his muzzle and ears were more pointed also. He was still just as active, though, and would grab something like a shoe or hat, and the owner would have to give chase. The ship landed in Glasgow, Scotland. The sergeant in charge made sure the coyote was treated just like everyone else. Just as each man had dog tags, engraved metal pieces giving a soldier's name, rank, and serial number, so did Jeep. He was listed as Jeep, NMI, Coyote. NMI stood for no middle initial. He also had flight and medical records. Traveling through Scotland and then England by train, Walt and Jimmy looked longingly at the passing countryside. They passed small thatched-roofed farmhouses with smoke rising slowly from the chimneys, chickens scratching in the yards, and some stone churches with adjacent graveyards, where many of the headstones tilted at precarious angles. Jimmy was excited when they saw the ruin of a castle on a hill nearby.
"This is just like the movies. Can't you just see King Arthur and his knights riding over that hill on their chargers, swords in hands? Man, I keep thinking we'll see Robin Hood or Little John step out from behind a tree," added Walt.
None of the men knew much about the area, but they did know they'd be living in Playford Hall. Walt imagined Playford Hall would be similar to his college dormitory, a boxy rectangular building with 2 or 3 floors and rows of windows on each side. The bus drove down narrow gravel roads out in the country. When it stopped, the driver said, "Hey, y'all fellas." The men looked around in surprise. All they saw was a 2-story redstone building shaped in an L with 11 chimneys and a moat with a stone bridge over it.
"Come on, you must be kidding us. Where's Playford Hall, really? This looks like a mansion."
"This is it," insisted the driver.
"I came to England to fight in a war," said Walt, "and I'm going to be living in a building that looks like a castle? Wait till I write folks back home. They'll never believe this."
They could see that Playford Hall had once been a very handsome building, but was now somewhat run down. It looked like it could be at least 200 years old. Tangled rose bushes grew up on the sides of the hall and spread down the sides of the moat where external fuel tanks for airplanes had been piled. There was no water there now. A few red roses were beginning to bloom in the spring air. Just as Walt put Jeep down, a small brown rabbit ran by and disappeared down a hole. The coyote ran over and eagerly sniffed at the hole, but the rabbit was gone. Walt could see that Jeep would have fun chasing rabbits every chance he got. Walt and Jimmy were assigned to the same room in Playford Hall, along with a couple of other men. But what would they do with Jeep? Walt learned that some of the pilots who had been there longer also had pet dogs. He got a wooden crate from the caretaker and made a house where Jeep could sleep behind a nearby workshop building, along with the other pets. When no one was playing with him, Jeep stayed tied beside his kennel. The airbase was just a short distance away from Playford Hall, so it was within easy walking distance. Walt was anxious to meet his maintenance crew and begin assessing the work that would be needed on his P-47 before he could fly missions. He liked his crew chief, Hugh, and knew right away that they would be able to work well together. Walt knew he was putting his life in his crew's hands, so he had to trust that they had done their jobs well. In the days ahead, they went over every inch of the plane. Since Walt didn't have much time to spend with Jeep, he sometimes brought him along to the airfield. He would drop the Coyote into the cockpit. Jeep would either sit upright in the seat with his paws resting on the edge, looking over the side, or curl up and go to sleep. Hugh and the rest of the crew became friends with the Coyote right away. Walt had flown several successful missions. As he was getting ready to close the canopy and take off on another one, Hugh signaled for him to stop, and he ran over to the edge of the field where he picked something up. "Jeep!" cried Walt in dismay. "How did you get loose? You're supposed to be tied up at Playford Hall." "How about taking him with you?" shouted Hugh over the roar of the engine. Both young men knew that the Coyote running on the airstrip when planes were taking off could cause an accident. "Do you really think so?" asked Walt. "Why not? Jeep's already used to the cockpit. And you're not flying very high today, so you wouldn't need an oxygen mask. I'm not sure we could find one to fit on a Coyote's pointy snout." Quickly, Hugh lifted the Coyote up to Walt. Jeep settled on the floor under his legs. Then Walt closed the canopy and waited for the signal to start taxiing to the runway. "Here we go, Jeep!" Walt shouted, as the plane raced down the runway, picking up enough speed to rise into the air. As the plane left the ground, Jeep gave one yelp, then settled down on the floor as if he did this every day. Walt's mission this day was doing reconnaissance or identifying potential dangers over Holland and Belgium, which were just across the English Channel. It wasn't going to be a long mission. When the flight was over, Hugh hurried up. "How'd it go?" he asked. "Jeep's a natural. He really seemed to enjoy it," answered Walt. "What a good boy. Maybe we'll have to do it again sometime." Months passed. The war raged on. After an especially long, hard day, Walt was one of the last pilots to return to the base. He'd been flying low over Belgium when one of his wings had been hit by any aircraft gunfire from the ground. His plane dove dangerously, and his heart pounded as it took all his skills as a pilot to turn and keep it upright. He was flying so low he sometimes thought he might hit the chimney of a house. He had radioed for an airplane escort to help him get back to the airfield. It had been a slow trip home. When he got back, he was exhausted. He went to check in at the flight shack, and he noticed that Jimmy had not returned. "Did Jimmy forget to sign in?" Walt asked. "I thought he'd be back before I was." Then he noticed the sad, worried looks on everyone's faces. "He hasn't come in yet," said one of the men. "Another of our boys thought he saw Jimmy's plane take a hit and dive into the ocean. He didn't see any parachute open either." "Oh, no," cried Walt as he sat down, put his hands over his face. I don't want to believe you." "None of us do. But the other pilots who flew over that area later didn't see any sign of aircraft debris. And they didn't see any parachute floating in the water." With a heavy heart, Walt finished his paperwork and then went to see Jeep. They went to a grassy place where they sat down. "Oh, Jeep," said Walt. "It looks like Jimmy's not coming back. What are we going to do? The dream I had back in the States must have really been about Jimmy, not me." Tears slid down his cheeks, and Jeep turned to lick his face. He understood Walt's grief and sat quietly beside him. As the days shortened with the coming of fall, Walt's routine was pretty much the same, flying missions, helping his crew with repairs, and taking time off now and then for rest periods. If Jeep saw Walt heading for the airfield, he jumped barked and tugged at the rope that kept him tied. He'd already flown 5 flights with Walt and didn't like being left behind. One day in October, as he hurried past Jeep's kennel, Walt said, "Not this time, Jeep. This one will be too high for you. See you when I get back." When Walt got back much later in the afternoon, he was surprised to see Hugh waiting for him in the flight shack. "What's the matter, Hugh?" he asked, seeing his friend's sad face. "You look like you've lost your best friend."
"We have," said Hugh. "It's Jeep. He must have pulled hard enough on his rope that it came loose. He ran into the road in front of a truck. Driver swerved, but it was too late. He was so sorry, but there was nothing he could do."
"Worse hell," thought Walt. He felt as if he'd been punched hard in the stomach. First Jimmy, and now Jeep. He'd lost 2 of his best friends to this war. When Walt got ready that evening to bury Jeep's body, he chose a quiet spot under a tree next to Playford Hall. The word of Jeep's death traveled quickly around the area, so many of the other men joined to give the coyote a full military funeral. The squadron chaplain began a spur-of-the-moment service by saying, "We are gathered here to pay homage to an American who flew in combat and died on foreign soil in the service of his country." Jeep was given a 21-gun salute with the pistols all pilots wore. One airman played taps on a bugle. As the coyote was lowered into the bed of fresh roses, all the men stood at attention and saluted, paying respect to the animal they all considered a friend. The next day, wanting to pay one last tribute to their faithful mascot, Walt and 3 other pilots took up their P-47s and flew the Lost Man formation. When they were over Playford Hall, one of the planes peeled away from the others to represent a missing airman. When finished, Walt took one last pass alone and did a slow victory roll over the gravesite. "So long, Jeep," he whispered. "We couldn't have got this far without you. You were one of us, a true American."
You are listening to Michigan Writers on the Air on IPR News Radio. If you joined us in the middle of the program, that was Benjamin Bush reading from Jeep, the Coyote Who Flew in World War II. Sharon Chickering Mahler, the author of Jeep, is in the studio with me. Welcome, Sharon.
Thank you for having me.
Sharon, where did this story come from? What part of your family history?
My dad was in World War II. He was a fighter pilot, and he spent his time near Ipswich, England, at the air base Martlesham Heath.
And the story of Jeep, the coyote, that was his story or story of friends?
The coyote was in the same unit with him, but it belonged to a different man. A different man brought him over to England.
And how did you hear about the coyote and these other stories?
My dad would, when he would come back from his reunions with his fellow airmen, would bring back stories. He'd bring back different stories each time. One fellow pilot, Ed, who was very close to the coyote, and he wrote down some of the stories for me. And so I used those as the basis for my book.
This is a story about war, about World War II. Is it appropriate for young children? I should note in the preface to Jeep, you provide the following caveat, and I'm quoting here, "Like many stories about heroes, this one does not have a happy ending." Close quote.
I had a friend read the book, and he was a young boy, and he was quite devastated at the end. So then that's when I put the caveat in that not all stories about heroes have happy endings.
But it is a true story about war.
Yes. I struggled for some time about how to depict war because I didn't want to romanticize war. I didn't want all the little boys to say, "Oh, yes, I want to go to war." And I didn't want them to try to go out and trap a coyote to bring home as a pet. So that's why I wrote the beginning part. I wanted to describe a historical event with a unique perspective that I thought kids could relate to. I didn't want the story to be lost because I think it's so special. Jeep was the only mascot in World War II known to have flown in at least 5 combat missions. More than about the war, I felt the story was about friendship, loyalty, and loss. And at the end of the book, I gave some questions for thought.
Can children read this on their own?
It is geared toward children ages 9 to 12, but for parents who feel that their children are especially sensitive, they might want to read the book with them.
I think that's really good counsel. Parents can explain some of the things that happen in war and help the child through it.
Right. And my husband has said all along, this isn't a book just for children. It's for adults, too.
Well, I think that's especially fitting for people our age because our fathers brought back stories about war. But
right.
If your father was like mine, you didn't hear those stories for years. And in the book, The End, you mentioned that you actually visited the site of where this story happened.
Yes, we visited the Martlesham Heath Aviation Society, which is the building that they flew out of. And 2 men showed us around the area, and we got to visit Playford Hall, where Jeep was housed, Jeep and his airmen.
Now, I should note that I edited the story for time. There's much more detail in the book, and you really give us a view of what England was like in the 1940s at the time
right,
of the war.
Right.
Beautiful, beautifully done. Are there other resources that people can use for information about this story?
There's a very nice website that was put up by the family of the original Walt. His name was not Walt, it was Bill. The website is www.wildbillcrump.com.
Yes, I've looked at the website, and the pictures of this cute little puppy Jeep hanging out of the cockpit of a
P-45
are really wonderful.
Aren't they?
That's a great website. Where can listeners find out more about you and about this book?
I have a Facebook page, Sharon Chickering Mahler Historical Fiction. People can see more photos there.
Okay. And where can listeners purchase a copy of Jeep?
It's available through Horizon Books here in Traverse City, Brilliant Books, and also on Amazon.com.
Sharon Chickering Mahler, thank you for being here. Thank you for sharing the story of Jeep. Fleta Brown is here. Welcome, Fleta.
Hi, Aaron. I'm glad to be here again.
And this month?
I'd like to talk about a collection of poems called Oz by Nancy Imers, who's a professor of creative writing at Western Michigan University in Kalamazoo. She's won 2 NEA fellowships, you know, the big $25,000 ones that have also been won, interestingly, in our area by Teresa Scollin and Francine Harris. And she's won a Pushcart Prize as well as a Nation Discovery Award and a Whiting Writers Award. Oz is Imers' 4th book, published by Carnegie Mellon University Press. It's a book dense with a number of prose poems and small print, which might feel a little off-putting, but the poems inside are so rich, the book is worth reading from beginning to end in that order. You have the feeling of reading a novel, almost, in the number of images that are woven from poem to poem. The title, Oz, of course, is from Frank Baum's The Wizard of Oz, and I can see why. Baum, she tells us, was not only an author, but also the one who dreamed up the idea, and this is interesting, that stores should be, and now I'm quoting from the title poem, grand enough to intimidate shoppers so you and I would find ourselves unnerved and grope to speak with cash in our hands, in your hands and mine, those loose, unending sentences.
Wow.
We wander this way through our lives in these poems, from the front lawn to parking lots, into mine shafts, to war, to Florida with penguins, and north to glaciers. And considering the time of year, I'd like to read you the one called Glaciers. Glacier. To watch this losing part of itself, this frozen dash, a sign, a pause, a being poised, cliffhanger, at the speed of ice. Just think, says the ranger, it's made of individual snowflakes. I love that bend of her voice into my head where her sentence goes on, compressed into a vastness, making this one incredible thing moved along by the force of its enormous weight, finding its way down out of the mountains, in the shape of an S, relentless plurality, all those battered snowflakes to the sea. At one place in its side, three ice caverns, two eyes and a mouth, so like, so strange, Munch's The Scream. Each calving's a fusillade, the sound and outpouring of anything, an inner surge. If there is a waiting, it is ours, watching the face change its expression every time a chunk of ice breaks off. And yet, behind it, this entirety, boundless, immense, this tidy sum, the face forlorn, dejected, hangdog now, our faces turned to it, our eyes and cameras trained on it, as if to document the very moment something in us changed, the ship turning in place, deft for so big a thing, while all along immensity recedes so incrementally we just can't put a human face on it. I see individual snowflakes, the small moments Imers brings into all her poems, and then the great distance of seeing the entire glacier. The book's center section is concerned with dollhouses, and then by extension, the boxes that the artist Joseph Cornell made with little figures inside. You may be able to kind of picture those kind of cigar boxes like, and sometimes bigger. We look at our world the way Dorothy in The Wizard of Oz sees Oz, full of tiny people and seemingly toy characters, and then returning home, loving home all the more for having left. Distance and closeness. Distance and closeness. Actually, they're simultaneous in these poems. Here's a part of a long one. It's from that middle section and is called How We Thought About Toys. The epigraph tells us that in 1943, Joseph Cornell spent 8 months testing radio parts in a defense plant, which figures in the poem a little bit. Here's the portion I want to read. You can see what looks like rows of houses in aerial photographs of the rooftops of the bomber aircraft factories of Lockheed and Douglas, but they are toys. Each dollhouse has life-sized emptiness. Well, no, not really, no. For there are silver crafts inside. And between the houses, there are regular intervals, as any child building a dollhouse town would by instinct or simple mimicry allow, lawns and shrubs, an almost loving attention to detail, so if clouds did not intervene, an enemy bomber pilot looking down could imagine all he couldn't exactly see, lawn chairs, barbecues, bicycles, the war toys, Cortland mechanical military gun car, Sky Raiders game, tank bank, 10 fighter plane, a general purpose ammo carrying bag, the German Tipio wind up 10 toy bomber airplane bomb, Or maybe he just saw the passed-by look of a sad little town. Maybe he looked down as a homesick child. Joseph Cornell, just this once, you were not making a toy. So here we are, aware of all this dangerous life, looking in on it like a child with a dollhouse, but being inside it too. In the last section of the book is a poem called My Parents Contemplate Moving a Last Time. You can see how Imers has moved her interest in houses all the way to the end of the book. This is My Parents Contemplate Moving a Last Time. They speak as if they have 1,000 years to go about recalibrating numbers, the distance from home to church and shopping, couch to television, degree and slant of light in the laundry room. Light to dark and wall to wall they have been traveling, years of back and forth between each other's eyes and mouths. He asleep in his chair at night, she riding the dip she always rides at her end of the couch. They seem to know time as an ordinary thing, as they sit and procrastinate forever over USA Today and the Arizona Republic, half decaf, melon and toast. No map of future's day or night, the shallows marked with squiggly lines, the depths not marked, they are that steep, will guide them. Nor do they seek the blueprint of a wave. More coffee, honey? Pass me the jumble, please. I watch them contemplate their move so quietly, it resembles just sitting there over breakfast, talking themselves backwards toward the smallest house in the universe. As I said, Oz is Imers' fourth collection. The two most recent are from Carnegie Mellon University Press, the others from Purdue and Wesleyan. I would advise checking them all out. She's an intelligent and skillful poet whose angle of vision on the ordinary is extraordinary. The poet is Nancy Imers.
Thank you, Felita. Thank you for listening to Michigan Writers on the Air. I'm grateful to Anne-Marie Oman, Benjamin Bush, Sharon Moeller, and Felita Brown. Also, kudos to Brock Moorman and Peter Payette for their skillful engineering and production work on the show. This program is a production of Interlochen Public Radio. Be sure to listen next time to Michigan Writers on the Air on IPR News Radio. Until then, I wish you great writing, great reading, and the best of all words.